Amiano finding himself in a water tank.
He's up in the water tank, and the American helicopter lands, and he's so happy. So he jumps out of the water tower, and he said, he's from New Jersey, so he says, "Are you going to Neutron?" And the helicopter pilot says, "No, I'm going to Neutron." So Tom says, "It's all right, take me with you."
That is great.
He's really a funny guy.
Yes.
I mean, if you get to talk to him.
Well, I'm going to definitely try.
He maintains his sense of humor in his professional life and in his public service. So it's great. But, so anyway, so I went back to the lodge and prepared, told stories. And I was feeling jumpy. And then there was that May offensive.
Yeah, they call it mini-Tet.
Yeah. And it didn't really affect me. I don't think it didn't come to the lot or anything, except sort of indirectly. And so then I left, though. I left in May. And I'm not sure how that happened. I mean, maybe I was told that IBS had had this meeting and made this decision that maybe some of us should leave. I'm not sure how I got that information, but I did leave, and it felt kind of good to leave. Because I was scared. I wasn't very comfortable. Things were all upset. I mean, everything was different than it had been before. And I was going to be leaving anyway. I think that was some of the feeling. So it was just leaving a few months early. So I did. And people wanted me to come home. I think my family was worried. They'd lost touch, you know. Been a long time. So I just felt comfortable to be able to leave. So I did.
And you took a plane to?
Oh. Actually, yeah. I guess I flew to, I went to Vientiane. I went to Bangkok and to Vientiane. I stayed in Vientiane for a couple of weeks. I met Diana Gardner, who's now married to Bui Chi, I think. Vietnamese man. Diana Gardner had been an IVSer in Banh Mi Thuot.
I'm trying to remember because Bui Xian's son was married to an IVSer? His daughter. I guess that's the same thing. Oh, it doesn't matter.
But she had been in Banh Mi Thuot. She was also visiting Vientiane at that time. So we piled around together, had a good time. And I just saw her again for the first time a year ago or so.
Where does she live?
She lives in Washington. And she works for the some Southeast Asia thing. You know.
It was Diana Gardner.
Yeah.
And now she's married to Bui.
Yeah.
She?
I'm not sure that. I think her name is Diana Bui. So
Diana Bui, right.
But maybe Bui Chi, it's Chi Bui. You know, maybe his family name is Bui.
Right. And but she's in D.C. and she works for some Southeast Asia organization. We'll just ask them. Donald.
Yeah, he knows exactly. It's, yeah. And I really enjoyed being in Laos. It's gorgeous. I went to Luang Prabang. I went to Pak Song or Paksay.
Paksay.
Not far away, but a closer one to Vientiane. Took all day to get there on a jeep. But I loved it because it was very beautiful and simple, and there was no war. I mean, no apparent war that was in the way of having a good time. Anyway, and Luang Prabang is spectacular. I mean, lots of gorgeous pagodas. Really, and flamboyant trees and a river and a really exotic, tropical, beautiful spot. So then I went to, I stopped off in Kabul for a few days, and then I went to Islamabad because my brother's ex-wife, now ex-wife's dad was U.S. ambassador to Pakistan. So I went to his house, and he wasn't there, but his secretary, this young American woman, took care of me. And I stayed in, it was a gorgeous house, and I had Indian food, which I've never been a strong fan of Indian food. I mean, curry is fine, it makes curry, it's good. But this was like something I've never had before in my life. It was mouth-watering. It was just gorgeous. It was wonderful. It was just many, many dishes. I mean, there would be little bits, little condiments, and little, ooh, just little subtlety, ooh, yummy stuff. Really wonderful. So that was...
Mughalized style. That's a style, I think.
Oh, no.
Nobody eats curry in India.
So. Oh.
As you know curry, nobody eats
curry. Oh. Huh.
I've never had anything I've eaten at a restaurant that
is like what
actually in India, except if you go to a Mughalai restaurant, and that's kind of if you order more than number 22, you get that kind of food.
Ooh. Mughalai, how do you spell that?
Yeah, Mughlai. Mughlai.
Mughlai. Mughlai.
Yes, or Mughlai, depending on how you want to spell the word mogul.
Hmm. Because that would be worth searching for.
Oh, yes.
Because that was really spectacular. I love that. But then she drove me around. We went to Peshawar. And that was all very interesting. And then I went to... By this time, my sister was living in Vienna. So I visited her in Vienna. Oh, yeah, this was good. Good question that you asked. Because this was my re-entry. And I think everything was kind of okay through the third world part of this trip. But by the time I got to Western Europe, to Vienna in particular, that was like culture shock for me. And it was, I couldn't get over the obsession that people had over things and the amount of energy that people spent making decisions about whether to buy this pair of shoes or that pair of shoes. I remember walking at night in Vienna back home from somewhere, and there was a store window full of shoes all lit up, and people were gathered outside the store window looking at all the shoes for a long time, and they were talking about this one and that one, and they all had different prices, and they were different colors. And this was like a big thing for them. And I just thought, hey, shoe's a shoe. It's not that big a deal, you know. There are other things. You know that in the rest of the world, you know, people don't have shoes. And I just, as supermarkets were, I couldn't get over how sterile and, you know, everything was wrapped in plastic. You know, and you couldn't really see the food or smell it or touch it. It was alienating. I mean, I felt cut off from that experience. And I thought, you know, in Vietnam, and this continued after I got home, I thought, in Vietnam, one's life, there's nothing between you and life. There's love, and there's hate, and there's war, and there's peace, and there's life, and there's death, and it's all right there, it's in your face, and you're living it. But in the West, people don't, they're several steps removed from all these things. You don't have real experiences. You read about others' experiences, or you experience them indirectly. You're protected, you know, you're shielded. It was off-putting to me to be in the West again. And, you know, a lot of it revolved around this whole thing of consumption and the amount of energy and money that was invested in consumption. But also, later on, when I got to school, I came here to Berkeley in Southeast Asian Studies, and I often felt that experience was not as satisfying as being in Vietnam. Because again, I was reading books, but books were just black and white pieces of paper. And it was what people were writing, I was reading about what other people were doing or thinking, instead of being an actor, a participant. I was an observer, a passive armchair, you know, participant in life. And I thought, hey, I don't like this. I mean, I didn't really enjoy school. I was very itchy and uncomfortable in school.
Well, when did you, what happened between the time you came back from Europe and went to graduate school? Did you go directly to graduate school?
No, I went home to my parents' house.
Uh-huh. That's okay. And you went home back to your parents' house and decided, what am I going to do next?
No, I had thought about that when I was in Vietnam. Uh-huh. And this is Maylin.
Hi.
How are you?
Hi.
And
hi.
This is Jay. And this is Mark with a C.
Mark with a C. Hi.
Hi.
I love your oral history account.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. But we're almost done here, so we'll get out of your way.
Okay.
So when you...
So I went to my parents.
You went to your parents.
And that was, you know, it was okay, but my... I didn't do much. I kind of just hung out and vegetated for a summer. Oh, I had planned to go to Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
I met David Marr
in
Vietnam. And I liked him, and he kind of counseled me.
What was David doing then? Was he a journalist then?
He was, no. He was teaching at Berkeley. He had finished his doctorate.
He was teaching at Berkeley, and he was doing research.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Uh-huh. And you met him, where do you remember meeting?
In Dalat, actually. See, like, there was a meeting at my house. My house was used for a meeting by David and some of these older student leaders that he'd known in the early 60s who were active in the Voluntary Youth Association and another group called CPS. Development program or something like that. Anyway, sort of activist students who are interested in community development. And another person who came to this meeting was one of these CIA guys who now lives here in California somewhere. There are actually two people, I can't remember their names, and I don't know their full story. One was older, one was younger, but the older guy was at my house that time. And it was sort of like a farewell. He was leaving, I can't remember the situation.
David was leaving.
No, this old CIA type guy. Anyway, I met David Marr, and he, because, you know, going to school was the only other thing I knew how to do. So I thought, well, now I've had this experience in Vietnam, now I want to learn more about it, kind of study the history and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, yeah, well, you should come. And he was my teacher, too, at
that's great.
At Berkeley.
That's
and then we ended up working together in this sort of anti-war organization with Fred Brantman after the war. And now he's our friend, even though he lives in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
But we saw him last year in Vietnam.
Oh, that's great. I corresponded with him on by email.
Oh, good.
Just once. He had some information that I knew he had, so I respect him immensely.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that. And when the tape's over, I want to talk to you a little bit about
okay,
it.
Right.
But so you came to Berkeley, and you found a little bit kind of manqué. I mean, it's kind of...
Manqué.
Removed. And,
yeah. I mean, one thing, see, coming to Berkeley in 1968 actually...
I remember that.
...offered its own kind of
yes.
interest,
uh-huh.
you know. And... You know, one of the big things, of course, was, well, we had People's Park. And People's Park, in many ways, was kind of like a metaphor for Vietnam, because it was...
That was there.
Oh,
sure.
Okay.
Why do you think I kept coming up all the time? but yes, People's Park was kind of a metaphor for Vietnam.
Right, okay. So I knew what was happening with People's Park, and I knew what... I could relate to it all, you know. You know, fighting over this little piece of real estate, and Reagan brought in the troops, and we were the enemy, and he turns his guns towards us, and helicopters spraying tear gas on us, and every day for several weeks, we had guerrilla warfare on campus, you know, where the police were chasing us, shooting rubber pellets, killing people.
I was always afraid that the you know, I can't remember what we called it, but there was a name for it, that they weighed like 270, 300 pounds. I was afraid they were going to die of a heart attack while chasing one of the students.
Oh, yeah. But
so you were at Berkeley in 68.
Right, and 69 and 70 and 71, you know, and I mean, People's Park was 70 or something, and well, it was all kind
of. Yeah, it wasn't later than 70.
I mean, there was the Cambodian invasion, where all the campuses, Kent State, shut down. And at Tuyet, my wife spoke at a rally in the Greek theater. So she was in a group of Vietnamese students, the first to come forward to speak out, you know, as students on student visas in this country, to join with the American anti-war movement to speak out. And she, among her peers, was the one asked to speak because her English was the best, I think. So that was a big experience, actually, when she did that, because then everybody knew her. And she was very beautiful, and she was wearing her aozai, and, you know, it was very, very powerful event. So it took me a long time to get my master's degree because I was kind of in and out of school because there was all this stuff going on. You know, a series of, there was a third world strike, and then there was People's Park and Kent State Cambodian invasion thing. But it was all, I mean, we all had really good feelings about ourselves, I think, during those years. I mean, that's one thing Maylin kind of has pointed out to us, speaking from her generation's perspective, was that we had such a clear goal that we knew what was right and what was wrong and where we stood and what needed to be done and how to do it. And every day we woke up, we knew what we were going to do. We were really There weren't self-doubts, you know, about...
And now?
And now for her or for
no,
me?
No, for you. Now when you look back, were you right?
Yeah.
Were things so clear?
Yeah. We won.
Uh-huh.
You know, or I mean, we helped.
Uh-huh.
You know.
You helped end the war.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, because my... You know, I was sort of learning about Vietnam, and then I was involved in these activities, and then I went on to join David Marr and others, and I both, to work, well, he set up the Indochina Resource Center in Washington, and we went to work with him. And, you know, our center was really, I think it had a lot of credibility. In fact, Ellsworth Bunker in Gloria Emerson's Winners and Losers credits us with the fall of Saigon.
No, that was Don Luce's fault. Everyone agrees. Fred Brantman and Don Luce lost the war in Vietnam.
Oh.
Don't try to claim their credit. They have no.
No, I'm just
that's
quoting Ellsworth.
I know, I'm kidding. Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
But see, well, our Indochina Resource Center, Don Luce was on the second floor.
Mm-hmm.
We were on the third floor, and Fred was on the fourth floor
mm-hmm.
of 1320 to 18th Street. You know, so we were all kind of in it together. And I worked with Don, Tuyet and I both worked with Don with the Indochina Mobile Education Project for a while. But most of our time was with the Indochina Resource Center. But, I mean, for us, what we did, I think we had a lot of credibility. Journalists would come to see us before they would go out to Vietnam. We often provided the conduit for spokespeople from Vietnam who either came to visit or we would have documents, like from the student movement in Vietnam, we would have documents which we could then translate and provide to the press. We provided testimony before congressional subcommittees in Congress. We set up press conferences for visiting Vietnamese Buddhists, for instance. I really feel like we played a significant role because of our language capability. That was the unique thing. I mean, we had background. I mean, under David's, you know, shepherding, he was really the main guy. We worked in the George McGovern campaign, or one of our staff people did, as a kind of Vietnam advisor.
Did you see that exchange between him and Senator McCain on Robert McNamara's book?
Oh, no.
They had a panel with Robert Scheer.
Oh.
And it was kind of funny, but McCain, McGovern said, if I'd been elected president, you never would have been a POW.
Oh.
And he said, if you'd been president, I'd still be a POW. It was a wonderful little exchange. Ooh. And then in the end, McCain said that no matter whether the anti-war movement was right or wrong, he said, I would rather spend 20 years as a POW in Hanoi than have the American people not have the right to express their opposition to a war.
Hmm.
Big breakthrough. Mm-hmm. That's a big moment.
Wait a minute, who said that last week?
Senator McCain. He was in the Hanoi Hilton. And it has supported the normalization.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, he's a Republican, and he has certain commitments that he has to make, and he's a veteran, and he has other commitments. But he stood with Clinton for on the normalization issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was important.
And the point he made, of course, was the only one that, as Americans, we would accept, which mm-hmm. is, that's why you're fighting.
Mm-hmm.
You're fighting to. By the way, I said this to Steve Young, and it went right over his head. Do you know Steve Young?
No.
Good.
Huh.
He's running for a Republican senator in Minnesota, probably. He's a very strange man. I'll put that on record. He's just strange.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't really grasp the fact. He thinks the anti-war movement destroyed America.
Oh.
And my point is, even if it did, without it, what would America be?
Uh-huh.
That is, if you can't even be wrong, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. And he had an article in the Wall Street Journal
mm-hmm.
saying that all the anti-war movement leaders should be called before Congress to testify why they were so wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he believes they were wrong. But the point is, bringing mm-hmm. American people to by subpoena
mm-hmm.
to testify about their own political beliefs?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what are we talking about here?
Yeah.
And if you say McCarthy, they say, oh, McCarthy was good. It was William F. Buckley has said that it was anti-McCarthy hysteria which mm-hmm. dominates our political culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all invented. McCarthy mm-hmm. wasn't that bad. He wasn't that threatening.
Mm-hmm.
It was the left's hysteria about McCarthy mm-hmm. that we... Mm-hmm. You know, in a part, that's true. I mean, the bugaboo, you know, the boogeyman
mm-hmm.
of McCarthy is an important part of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a boogeyman. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like saying, well, people just invented Adolf Hitler. No.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think he was real.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you did this, do you think looking back, the IBS experience provided the foundation for this later work? That because you had spent time with IBS, what did you think about IBS after the war, as years went by? Were you a member of the Alumni Association when it started?
No. I've never really related to IVS as an organization. Mm-hmm. I don't really feel loyalty or affection for IVS mm-hmm. as an organization. I mean, it was just the place where I work. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. the organization I worked for. The people, I mean, I feel really close to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the experience, but not the organization so much. Mm-hmm. And you know, I don't contribute to IBS.
Mm-hmm.
I get their mailings. I never respond to them, I guess. I always like to read. I always like reading about what people are doing, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but that's like watching NPR and not contributing, not pledging. You can't read the stuff and not pay for it.
Yeah. I might, if they make me pay, I do. I can't remember, you know, if as a condition.
I'll pass that on to the Association. Start telling them no more newsletters.
I think I got a mailing recently, which I may have put in that same drawer.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure if I responded, you know, asking me to pay something for an IBS directory or something. I did that, I think.
Well, after you worked for the Indochina resource, whose sign I noticed you still have.
Yeah.
And by the way, I have the sign for the only acid head shop in Westwood, which was called Krishna's Village.
Oh.
And when they tore the building down, I got the sign. It's a giant peak sign with a Krishna in perfect day glow, mm-hmm. you know, 60s mm-hmm. writing. I'm very happy with that. It's in mm-hmm. my parents' garage, and I'm just waiting for the appropriate moment to
mm-hmm.
install it in my home.
Mm-hmm.
It's 10 feet high. But mm-hmm. After you worked that, did you get your doctorate at Berkeley?
No.
How far did you go?
Master's
degree. Mm-hmm. In Southeast Asian Studies?
Yeah.
Okay. And then you worked for the Indochina Resource, and then what after? What did you do after that?
Well,
not so much chronologically, but what have you been doing since then, until now?
Okay, just real quick.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. So I worked at the center, and then in about 73, we moved a branch. We set up a branch of the center here in Berkeley. Mm-hmm. So there was a center in D.C. and a branch in Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And so David and another fellow, Keith Irvin, and Tweet and I rented a U-Haul truck, and we packed up a lot of boxes and stuff. And we drove across the country for 11 days. And we had a center over in the old Anna Head School on the Berkeley campus, a nice brown shingle building. And we continued the work there. But then, let's see, in 74, we had May Lin. And at that time, I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease,
oh,
which is a cancer of the
mm-hmm.
lymph system.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, I stopped working then. And I went to Stanford for treatment. And then the war ended.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what I was going to do. I had no... So much of my life had been oriented towards ending the war, or that was what I did in my life, and there was no more war, so now what was I going to do? And I was also dealing with disease, and I didn't know what my future was going to be like. But, you know, one thing that happened when I got sick was I started to learn about cancer and illness, and I'd never given it a second thought before, you know. And I started reading about things that caused cancer. I said, what? You know, there are things that we make that cause cancer? This is not right.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I felt, you know, I guess personally threatened by the fact that there were some people who found it in their economic interest to produce a product that might cause me to die.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided that was wrong. So I kind of, and then there was this environmental movement, so there was support for these kind of feelings in a whole movement. So I kind of became more of an environmentalist. And then I taught for a while in a course at Berkeley in environmental, you know, Environment 101 or something,
mm-hmm.
that a friend of mine was teaching. He hired me as a TA.
Mm-hmm.
I worked as a carpenter for a while. Then I got a job at the John Muir Institute.
Oh.
And they did integrated pest management here in Berkeley. And I thought that was really neat, which it was basically looking for alternatives to pesticides in pest management. And working there, I became kind of an expert, an untrained, self-made expert in health hazards associated with pesticide use. And I actually wrote a little book about it for the Palo Alto Library. That was a contract that they gave to me.
Oh, okay.
So it printed 6 copies, which are in the Palo Alto Library. Oh, I have one too. So anyway, I did all this work, but then I realized that I was kind of up against the problem that I had no legitimacy in the field. So I learned about this field called public health. And there was a school of public health at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
So I went there, and I got my master's in public health
mm-hmm.
from 82 to 84. And then I came out, and I got a job at UCSF, University of
mm-hmm.
California, San Francisco, with someone who had a cancer screening research project.
Mm-hmm.
And in public health school, my focus was on cancer prevention.
Mm-hmm.
That was the focus of my interest, was how do you prevent cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And one way is cancer screening, which is early detection,
mm-hmm.
So that you save lives. You don't prevent people from getting it.
Mm-hmm.
It's called secondary prevention.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked for him, and then he said I could, after a while, he said I could develop a project on my own if I wanted. So I wrote a proposal which was funded to survey Vietnamese living in the Bay Area about their cancer, their behaviors and beliefs related to cancer and cancer prevention. And that started a whole series of projects for the next 10 years up till this year, of working with the Vietnamese community in developing and evaluating programs in the area of cancer prevention, smoking, cancer screening, hepatitis B is another area.
Bad wound.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm very good at titles for books, by the way. I've just given you one for your next book.
Yeah.
On cancer screening and prevention. When Saigon fell in 1975, did you have any feelings about that? It's a loaded question. Go ahead and answer it.
Well, yeah, we were, both Tia and I were very excited. I mean, we were really happy. You know, I mean, we watched, we had a map on the wall. I was still having my treatment, so we were living in Mountain View. But we sort of put pins in the map as things unfolded. You know, our feeling was, you know, peace at last.
In Vietnam afterwards, of course, there wasn't the bloodbath that the right wing, of course, was touting.
Yeah. Well, let's see.
Because a lot of people who opposed the war just kind of just walked away from Vietnam.
Yeah.
I mean, it just didn't, it was, they'd done their job. And
right.
That was it. But of course, you had a much closer connection.
Right.
Vietnam.
Well, of course, we didn't really know what was happening too much for a while. Communication with my wife's family, who was in Ho Chi Minh City, was sporadic. But in 1979, Tuyet's brother showed up at this house with his wife, his pregnant wife, having fled Vietnam. So he was a reluctant draftee in the South Vietnamese Army, having been trained as an architect. And he was sent to re-education camp, but was used as an architect, so he built re-education camps.
Bridge on the River Kwai.
Yeah, right. But he left. And we heard from him from Malaysia after he reached the camp. And then subsequently they came and they lived with us for about 6 months.
He escaped from the education, or did he finish his term service?
No, he escaped.
He escaped.
Yeah, with his wife. And yeah, it was a scary, traumatic thing for them. So they lived with us right then in 70, was it 78 or 79? I think it was 79. And they had their baby here. So that was kind of nice, although there were some tensions in the family. Then in 1980, Tuy had applied to go to Vietnam to visit through the Vietnamese delegation to the United Nations in New York. And she was given a visa. So she and May Lin both went back for 3 months. So that was a long time. And I was here by myself. And May Lin was just 5. She turned 6 when she was there. But it was wonderful to be able to go back. And for Tuyet, it was really hard being separated from her country and not being able to have that contact, that you know, contact with the source of her culture. And but going to Vietnam was wonderful for her. It was just rejuvenating, and she came back a different person. I mean, it was just wonderful for her. And for May Lin, it planted this huge seed, you know, which is still growing. You know, that allowed her to understand that she was Vietnamese as well as being American, and that she was yellow as well as being white, and she loved her grandmother and her aunts and her cousins. and they loved her, and she had a great experience. Even though she couldn't really speak too well, but there was a lot of other communication. And then, you know, through the 80s, Tuyet went back like every other year for a visit. And Maylin usually went with her, not every time, but all but once, I think, actually.
Okay.
So she grew up with this strong tie to Vietnam. So, and then many of our friends, these friends from Dalat, the students, we would sit around in cafes, drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes, criticizing the Americans, how bad they were in the Republic of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them are now here,
mm-hmm.
you know. So that's just the way it goes. Not all of them. Some of them are there. Some are still in Vietnam. Some who went through re-education but didn't leave.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, this one guy who'd gone to Cô Lao Vẻ, for instance, mm-hmm. on that trip, close friend. He went to re-education. He'd written a thesis after we left, a criticism of Marxist theory.
Mm-hmm.
And that thesis put him
in the re-education.
In re-education. They had to turn him around.
Of course, maybe he'll be rehabilitated.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, none of the economists I met in Vietnam were Marxists any longer. So.
They didn't rehabilitate.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Because now he's a wealthy capitalist.
Oh, well, there you have it.
Uh-huh.
Well, at least he's been consistent. that's amazing.
Right.
It's amazing that...
But Tuyet saw him in 1980, shortly after he'd been released, and she's really seen his change, or his success over the years, which has been really interesting. And then she had another friend who was her good buddy, and unbeknownst to her, I guess... he was a member of the National Liberation Front.
Mm-hmm.
He became a school teacher in the girls' high school in Dalat,
mm-hmm.
and was recruited by one of his students,
mm-hmm.
you know, a young girl, 16 years old,
mm-hmm.
and then went off to the jungle and after the Tet Offensive or something like that. And so we visited him in Dalat, and he was working with the Fatherland Front, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But now he's in Canada.
Right, I was going to say, if he's with the Fatherland Front now, he's... not in Vietnam, or they make a big deal of that in Vietnam, by the way. If you go to the War Crimes Museum in Saigon, there's a hall of traitors, so to speak. They're very well, why would they regard all these people as revolutionaries, or counter-revolutionaries? They were trying to destroy the Vietnamese revolution.
But what's the connection to the Fatherland Front?
Actually, there isn't any. I was thinking of something else.
Oh, okay, good.
Okay, right.
Because I think what you're saying is a little bit true.
Why is he in Canada? No.
Well, that's just it. He got disillusioned with the revolution, and also the Fatherland Front is kind of where they park people that they're not quite sure what to do with,
mm-hmm.
and they have no power and no influence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's led to his frustration.
Mm-hmm.
So... I think for his children, that's what a lot of people will always say, but he thought that they would have a better future in the West.
And they let him go, or he just...
Kind of, I think. It was he didn't have to escape.
Mm-hmm.
He just got on a plane. I guess he must have gotten an exit visa or something. He had other family in Canada. But, so, you know, for us personally, we haven't had friends who suffered after liberation in re-education camps. We have a number of people we know in this country now,
mm-hmm.
Vietnamese Americans, who went through the re-education camps. And, I mean, that's a little bit of a tension for our lives here now, is that we have a different history and we don't share the same bitterness that many of the Vietnamese here now have about the communists.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to confess that Tuyet never lived under communism, which is what they will say. They'll say, well, you don't know. You left in 75. Well, Tuyet actually left in 68.
Mm-hmm.
So she even has less of an idea.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes her experience is not legitimate for them. So we never pressed the issue. You know, but it's, you know, we went through a period of where the anti-communist fervor among Vietnamese in this country was so strong, people were being killed, you know, for saying things in the newspaper or whatever.
You think that's moderated a bit?
Yeah. But we kept a very low profile for a long time. And went out of our way to avoid.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have too, actually. I think that, what time is it now?
Yeah, 2.
Okay, well, see, I'm supposed to be at John's already. Oh. As I say, and now this brings us to the end. Now we'll continue this.